Thank you all for coming, and thanks to my inviters, Rob and Jean, for inviting me to give a talk on this topic. When they first brought it up to me as far as the PCR application, application of PCR to community analyses, I thought, well, what's one of the best ways to do this? And I think starting in the past is a really good way of showing where we were quite a few years ago and where we've come to now. And I think our first slide shows this. And everyone who's taken an environmental micro class really knows what this is. The Winogradsky column, the father of environmental microbiology, Sergei Winogradsky. And this is really a simple and elegant a way of analyzing and looking at communities and the way these communities function with one another. And I just wonder, well, how would they have used a PCR or some of the high throughput methods to glean some of the information that you could glean from these types of columns? How would they apply that now? And I think that leads us to where we're at today, which is the use of PCR. And we all know PCR's history. 1986, Mullis's group was successfully able to amplify genomic DNA in vitro. And really what we've seen is the application of this technique from a clinical standpoint all the way to the environmental standpoint. And really for the past 20 years, we've seen the application of polymerase chain reaction to environmental studies. So when we look at environmental studies, one of the things that has really been a main point in environmental analyses has been the culture methodologies. Okay, I'm a pathogen guy, and one of the things we're always interested in are finding pathogens in the environment. And one of the ways we do this is to culture these organisms, to enrich these organisms, because we're interested in the live organisms. And the culturing technology has allowed us to do this. Well, PCR has only been able to enhance these techniques and even make them better. In some cases, some are trying to even replace the traditional culture methodologies with detection using, for instance, quantitative PCR. We know that with culturing, for instance, with bacteria, we're certainly only able to look at a very small portion, probably less than 1% of the available bacteria that are in the population with our culturing. So we're really limited with culturing. Using a non-cultivation technique such as PCR, such as the high-throughput methods, for instance, really enables us to get this information that we otherwise would never have been able to have figured out before. And like I said, you know, wondering how Sergei could have taken this information and really applied it to his work, it would have been amazing. So potential applications in the environmental studies, we've got, of course, the pathogen and fecal indicator detections, microbial source tracking, community analyses, sequence-based library studies, high-throughput studies, even the old-fashioned clone library studies. But one of the key questions is, what kind of approach do we use? How do we interpret the data? Are we going for a simple presence-absence, for instance? Is the presence of a gene in the environment as a result of our treatment? For instance, we land applied bile solids to a soil. Does that increase the presence of an antibiotic resistance gene? Likewise, are we interested in seeing upregulation and using quantitative PCR to deduce this information and determine, well, do we have any genes that are being upregulated in the environment as a result of our nitrogen fertilization treatment that we're doing, and how does that affect our community? So to give a few examples of a few papers that we're going to talk about in the next few slides, we've got the application of PCR in a number of studies. We've got my group from Arizona when I was out there using PCR to determine microbial communities and aerosolized bacteria in aerosols, the downwind of biosolids application sites. We've got Kim Cook's group out at Bowling Green, Kentucky, looking at spatial diversity of microbial communities in chicken houses, looking at the poultry litter. We got water detection. Terry Gentry's group out at Texas A&M, looking at high throughput methods to look at diversity in hypersaline soils. And we have Jordan Petchia's group at Yale looking at using quantitative PCR to determine differences in pathogens or presence of pathogens and numbers of pathogens in class B bile salts. So it's a number of applications, a number of different matrices that we can use PCR for. And we've got from fecal matter approaches to water to soil to air. So basically any matrix that you can think of, we have found a way to apply it to that matrix. So how do we take this data, and once we've decided what technique we're going to use, how do we take the data, what do we do, what do we start to work with, and how do we take it to the next step, how do we present this? Well, as I was saying, if you use a presence-absence approach or a quantitative PCR approach, you may be interested in how a gene is present in the environment, how you've upregulated it, for instance. But then you look at the community approaches, and you're looking at who's there, how many are there, what's their structure? What are they looking like when they're in a community? And this is our community analyses that we look at. And some of the example programs that are available to us, at least the ones that my group tends to use quite a bit, are the RDP, Ribosome Database Project for Michigan State. This is a wealth of knowledge and a wonderful cloud-based program that can be used for high-throughput studies, for clone library-based studies. And this is for 16S ribosomal RNA analyses. And there's a wealth of tools available on that particular website where you can compare library to library, whether it's on a spatial basis, a temporal basis, whatnot. The MOTHER program is another program that's available to us freely on the web. Wonderful program that has multiple library comparison tools that can be used in operational taxonomic unit classifications and comparisons, similarity indices, comparisons to one another. And this is a wonderful tool. I highly suggest anyone who's not worked with either one of these to visit these sites and take a look at them. Just Google them and you'll find plenty of papers and plenty of information about those two programs. For qPCR data, it's a little bit more simple. In this case, we're looking at increases in numbers as a result of a treatment, maybe a spatial distribution, a temporal distribution. But this is the simple type of interpretations that we're looking at. And my colleagues that are going to be talking a little bit later on in the morning will go into far more detailed discussions about some of these applications. So to give you some examples of some of the potential studies and things that you can use PCR for, we're looking at, here's a study that my group at Mississippi State has looked at. And essentially what we're doing here is we're looking at swine lagoons, swine manure lagoons, and we're looking at the effluent in these manure lagoons and the microbial communities and the presence of antibiotic resistance genes, the presence of pathogens, comparisons of quantitative PCR to cultural technologies, and I'm going to show you a few pieces of data associated with these. What you're seeing here is a graph with 16S PCR, quantitative PCR data, and we're looking at genomic units per 100 mLs of swine effluent. We have a log base 10 scale here. And what we're looking at are just the differences in farm types. And this is the type of data that we can get using quantitative PCR, and we're seeing that approximately 10 to the 12 genomic units of 16S ribosomal RNA are present per 100 mLs of effluent, and we're just comparing these across three different farm types, and we saw that there were no differences there. Another approach that we can look at is, as I was saying, the comparison of the presence of salmonella, of a pathogen, and we're using quantitative PCR here and comparing that to our traditional MPN technologies that we use, the most probable numeral technologies that we use where we're enriching for the pathogen in this case. So we're down here. This is the cultural techniques. We get about 10 to the 2 per 100 mLs using the cultural techniques. Using the quantitative PCR techniques, you have about a four-fold increase, about 10,000-fold times more genomic units detected versus the cultural techniques. And that leads me to Campylobacter as well. We saw the same thing. But that leads me to where I was going with some of this, in that if we're trying to replace some of the culture techniques with qPCR, we do a lot of risk assessment And that's one of the issues that we're coming across now, is how do we take this qPCR data and apply it to risk analyses? And risk analyses have traditionally utilized infectious data, live data. So how do you take this when there's such a large discrepancy between your culture-based techniques and your qPCR techniques, when there's a four-fold increase in qPCR data versus your culture techniques? How do you take that information? And there's really no solid answer at this point, and we're still trying to figure this out. Looking at antibiotic resistance genes in these particular swine effluents, we have tetracycline resistance, 10 to the 8 genomic units per 100 mLs. Another tetracycline gene that we're looking at, 10 to the 6 roughly, per 100 mLs as well. So we see that this is certainly a technique that can be applied for pathogens, for antibiotic resistance, but also for determining community constituents. In this case, this study used a combination of RDP analyses and a combination of the mother program that I talked about a little bit earlier. And we're seeing that looking at these farm types, that we have three different distinct communities, and when we analyze them with mother and when we analyze them with the RDP, we saw that there are distinct diverse communities between the three, and it was really a difference based on age of the pig in this case. So it's just an application of the PCR PCR assay and applying it to community analyses. So another approach that can be used for qPCR is Jordan Petchia's group. As I said earlier, in this case, they were essentially using qPCR exclusively to determine the presence of pathogens in Class B bile solids. And in this case, they're looking at adenovirus, Legionella pneumophila, Staph aureus, and Clostridium difficile. Other than Staph aureus, Legionella pneumophila, Clostridium difficile, and adenovirus, they tend to be a little bit more difficult to culture, costly in some cases. And so using a qPCR approach can certainly bring some of your costs down, particularly with adenovirus and even Clostridium difficile, which is a little bit difficult to work with if you don't have the right tools. So it's understandable how applying this kind of approach to these types of studies would really bring some of your costs down. But as I said earlier, how do we interpret some of this data if we're going to take it for further analyses, for instance, for a QMRA approach? Looking at a similar study out of Wong's group, we see that there are enteric viruses in Class B bile solids that they quantified using qPCR. We have levels of approximately, let's say, 10 to the 6 genomic units per gram. Comparing that to what they did with traditional cell culture approaches, you see about 10 to the 3. So that's about another 1,000-fold increase. So I'm reiterating that point that there are big-time differences between the qPCR and the culture techniques. And this is another similar study in which we compared, out at Mississippi State, we compared pathogen levels using both approaches. So another approach that can be used is source tracking, and this is Jordan Petchia's group as well when he was at Arizona State. And using these qPCR approaches and using PCR approaches, they were able to determine that Chloroflexi right here turned out to be a wonderful source tracking organism for aerosols downwind of bile solids applications. And it was they would not have been able to use this technique. They would not have been able to use Chloroflexi had it not been for a PCR approach. So once again, when things aren't cultivable, we have to go to a PCR approach, and that really helps us out. So now things are getting more towards what we originally were going to talk about, and that is communities and how we look at nitrogen transformation, for instance. And I know there's going to be a talk on that a little bit later on in today's discussion. Looking at Mao's group, they used a qPCR approach to determine the presence of nitrification genes in a bioenergy crop field. And in this case, they're looking at the presence of the NIF genes, the NOS genes, and looking at how these genes are upregulated as a result of specific crops that are grown on these specific lands. And once again, they used a gene technique, a qPCR technique, to do this. Likewise, they looked at the increase of the nitrification rate and how nitrification rate correlated directly with the increase in the AMOA genes as well. Another application is on the other end of the nitrogen cycle. We have denitrification genes and using qPCR to interpret this data. So increases in these particular genes as a result of addition of glucose to some soil samples that they had, and using qPCR to be able to determine these increases in these genes. And traditionally, we would have used some type of culture technique, and this is or physiological techniques. And this method is a really rapid approach that we can use, where we can get results essentially within probably about 2.5 hours of you know, terminating the experiment. So it's really nice to be able to get this kind of data quickly using qPCR. Another approach that can be that PCR can be used for is the TRFLP methods. Essentially, what we're trying to do here is we're fingerprinting communities. Okay, so if we have a community, it's under treatment X, and we have another community under treatment Y. And if you want to see a global change in their bacterial population, you can use a fingerprinting technique designed by Osborne, using the TRFLP method, terminal restriction fragment length polymorphism. And really what he did here is that where we would take our 16S ribosomal RNA gene, we would PCR amplify that and digest it traditionally with endonucleases. We would run this out on a gel normally. And you can pick up pretty decent differences when you do that on a gel. However, there are cases where we're not quite sensitive enough on a gel and using traditional staining techniques to detect some of these differences. Well, using the TRFLP method, which uses labeled primers, we can see differences in some of our soil. Sometimes it's a little too sensitive, but its specific application, it can certainly be used for many community analyses. But this is the type of data that you can get from using TRFLP analyses. Another approach, talking about Kim Cook's work out at Bowling Green, we've got the denaturing gradient gel electrophoresis, DGGE. It's another fingerprinting technology that can be used to determine differences in communities. In this case, she used this to determine differences in location within poultry houses. So looking at the microbial community within litter in a poultry house and looking at spatial differences in that. And you can use PCR techniques to do this and fingerprinting techniques to do this. So going back to some of my work, in this case this was out at Arizona, we're looking at the diversity of aerosols, the microbial diversity of aerosols generated from land application of biosolids, and we're looking at essentially what is the contribution of soil to the aerosol population, okay? And what is the contribution of biosolids? And what we found was that really that soil shared more operational taxonomic units with the aerosols generated from these operations, more so than biosolids did. Biosolids did not share really any and was far more unique than what we saw with soil. So what we saw in arid lands, at least, is that the generation of aerosols and the presence of bacteria in the air was more a result of aerosolized soil particles rather than biosolids. And so that's another application of community. This was clone library analyses. Another approach can be looked at is in poultry litter. In this case, we're looking at aerosols within poultry houses and looking at the communities at early stages of the flock cycle, late stages of a flock cycle, differences between the litter, differences between the aerosols. And once again, using a PCR, 16S PCR method, using the mother techniques, using the RDP analyses, we can glean some differences within the communities. Likewise, Zersky out at University of Arizona under Ian Pepper's group had looked at differences between biosolids land application, high-rate biosolid land application sites, and control sites and low-rate biosolids application sites, and looking at the microbial community using 16SPCR once again and using mother and the RDP, and you can there are strong differences between the biosolids application sites, at least as far as species richness was concerned. And finally, looking at the evolution of some of these community techniques, and that is where has the science gone over the last 6-7 years, and that has been the high throughput methods. And this is just an example of one paper, and there's quite a few that are coming out and quite a few that are already out using the high throughput methods. And this one was using the 454 method and looking at differences in hypersaline soils and looking at microbial differences based on physical chemical characteristics of these particular soils. And they used 454 technology, and they used traditional clone library techniques as well. And they, what it boiled down to is that they found that the high throughput methods, which could get possibly a thousandfold more sequences than the clone library techniques could, the high throughput methods would actually enable the researchers to have a far more sensitive approach, and you'd see species and sequences that you never would have seen otherwise. Without using this high throughput approach. And so that's an application of the PCR methodology to community analyses, and this is some of the further data that they had in there. So summarizing that, essentially what I wanted to do is really set up what my other colleagues are going to be talking about, because they're going to be going to some of these methodologies and really getting into some of the real specifics of these techniques. But overall, PCR is still extremely useful for community analyses. qPCR approaches has its place when we're trying to determine upregulation of a gene in an environment as a result of a treatment or a space or time. We know that even traditional presence-absence PCR still has its place if we're looking for the simple presence of a pathogen, the presence of a gene. If we're not necessarily interested in upregulation of that gene. The high throughput methods that we see now, 454 is actually kind of old, but some of the other methods that we've got now, those are really opening our eyes and really enabling us to just get all kinds of information. We're looking at millions of sequences now, as opposed to just 1,000 or just a few hundred that we used to before. Now we're looking at millions upon millions of sequences. So we're talking about gigabytes worth of data as opposed to just a few hundred megabytes worth of data. So the amount of information that we're getting from here and the programs that we're using are constantly evolving. There's a whole community out on the web that are working on new programs. Bioinformatics are really playing a big game in some of these programs and really starting to get to the heart of some of these problems and just handling some of this data. And I think that's the biggest issue that we see in front of us is how do we handle some of this data? And I think we're going to see that in some of the next few talks. And with that, I will shut up and we'll take some questions if we have time. I don't know if we do.
I think we have time for one question.
Yes.
You mentioned the difference in like fourfold and four log units in quantitative units and culturable. Mm-hmm. So does that presuppose that one cultural unit and one genomic unit are the same?
Well, in some of these cases, that is the assumption that's being made. But as we know, some genes are present at, you know, there's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 copies of a gene in a cell, depending on that cell's physiological state. So it's not necessarily true, but in these cases, that is the assumption that is being made. Yeah. Yes?
John, people are starting to use qPCR data for pathogen risk assessment analysis in human and animal waste. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think you can't really, at this point, we can't really use it without putting some kind of caveat upon that, because the qPCR methods don't really determine infectious numbers. We don't really look at cultural numbers in this case, and the quantitative risk assessment techniques, the dose response techniques, are based on infectious units. And at this point, it's really hard to determine if you have a million versus 100 copies. That's a order of four magnitude difference. That's difficult to really work with. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. We know that culture's not getting everything. We know that qPCR is probably getting too much. And it's just a matter of trying to develop some kind of ratio, for instance, that could work for these types of analyses. All right, thanks.